Hey, I'm Cody from Unqualified Gamers, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 108 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we take every lesson we've learned in our travels and try our best to emulate the Doctor to save the world from threats that by all scientific principles shouldn't even exist, to keep our very own companion alive during the process, and all the while trying to keep our significant other none the wiser. Yeah, this is going to work. I am one of your GPR hosts for the evening. My name is Keir. With me, as always, in the GPR studios is Haley Malley. Haley, how are you this evening?
Better now that the basement has been secured.
Yes. At the risk of equipment, she has beaten the Cretans into submission. And over there, preferably safe from all things two-dimensional and three-dimensional, is Jay. Jay, how are you, sir?
I'm doing okay now that I've turned all my posters around so I can't see them.
Yeah. Have you drawn really cool stuff on the back of them so that you can, when they get re-dimensionalized or biggerized?
Yeah, biggerized.
Nice. Well, what do we got this week, Haley?
This week we're going to add murals to the list of everyday things that Doctor Who has made us afraid of as we discuss Flatline, the second episode penned by Jamie Matheson. We've been talking recently about how Clara has become such a strong character of this series, and now we see her on her own adventure, proving that the Impossible Girl has become a character of the past, as we welcome Dr. Oswald.
PhD.
This episode, I'm just going to go ahead and say this. This is one of my favorites this season. It was absolutely fantastic and practically flawless, really, when you think about it.
Whoa. Yeah,
it's my favorite of the season, I think.
Bold.
It had the right balance of silly and scary that I really like.
Mm-hmm. Not too much in the science department or in terms of over-explanation of said science. So that's good.
You know, that's one thing that I got into a discussion about was the fact that, like, we never get any background on the aliens. We never know where they come from, how they get here, how the Doctor sent them back, any of that stuff. And that's part of the reason why it works, because it didn't get bogged down. It's a lot like the original, Dawn of the Dead, I think, where, or Night of the Living Dead or something. One of those old zombie movies where it's just like, they don't explain it. You're just sitting there watching a movie and then zombies. And you don't need to know how they were created, how it came about, anything. It's just, okay, zombies, let's run. And it works because you don't have any information. And I think we got the same effect here.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, just going so far as to say, you know, oh, well, it's something we've never even fathomed or been able to see, because you'd have to go on a really good diet. But yeah, I mean, it's that fringe of potential science where it's so far around the bend that you just, okay, sure. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. I can't even wrap my head around that. So fine.
So Haley, what were some of the things that you really liked about this episode? You said it's your favorite. So what are the things that stood out to you?
Anytime the Doctor, like, passed something to Clara out of the TARDIS tiny door from her purse, it's like, oh, that's how Hermione's bag works. That's how Batman's utility belt works,
yeah,
really.
Exactly.
There's a Doctor and a TARDIS there, and he just reaches in, and what he has comes out.
It's the box of holding, yeah. And I mean, that gag could have very easily been done wrong and been horribly cheesy, but it worked really well. And it was one of those where it's like, there were a couple times you're like, okay, yeah, fine, that's a little bit too much or something, but it never took you out of it, and it never seemed like it shouldn't have been there. It could have very easily been horrible, and it wasn't. So what were some of the other things you enjoyed about it?
Well, when, like, they first said, oh, these are 2D people, I was like, oh, it's just like that part at the beginning of A Wrinkle in Time where Mrs. Witch tries to take him to a 2D planet.
It's been so long since I've read those. I got to go back. It makes me think about it now. There was also, was it where they said, oh, you know, if you were, I forget what show it was I used to watch as a kid where they were trying to explain, you know, the if you were to live in a you know, one-dimensional world, everything would look like a dot. If you were in a two-dimensional world, everybody would look like a line. If you were, you know, and going about it that way. It must have been like the Electric Company or something like that, but or 3-2-1 Contact, one of those ones from back when the Earth cooled and dinosaurs roamed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was, this was like we're saying, it's one of those potential plot lines or plot devices that's so far out there that it's entertaining because it's definitely, well, with the exception of Madeline L'Engle, it's pretty original. Whoops.
Yeah. And you know, this was a great opportunity to really prove how far Clara has come. I mean, we've been talking about it the whole time that, you know, this season, she's so much better than she was previously. And she's absolutely amazing this time. Here, we actually see her taking on the role of the Doctor and proving what she's capable of. And it was just absolutely fantastic because it could have, again, it could have been something that would horribly over the top or just miss the mark completely. But, Matheson was able to really nail it here.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, although, I will say that I don't know if we can qualify this as a Dr. Light episode.
No, I mean, well, all of, when you think about it, though, it's all of Capaldi's scenes were shot in one day while they were doing, the Mummy on the Orient Express. Mm-hmm. So basically, like, they'd get done over there and they're like, okay, we're going to work on this. So he'd run over to the TARDIS set and film a couple scenes from this episode, then go back and do that. So everything and the editing in this was absolutely amazing because you believe the whole time that there is a dialogue going back and forth, that they're constantly talking to each other. Mm. When in all actuality, the majority of his scenes in this episode was just Capaldi on the TARDIS set doing his thing.
Talking to handles.
Did you actually notice that at some point, I noticed it when he was doing his dance, his hair was shorter.
Yeah.
And like brushed flat. And then it was like that until they went up to the surface again. Mm.
Well, it's kind of when siege mode kicked in, right? It was pretty much, you know, as soon as the life support systems shut down, his hair support system also failed.
Yeah.
When they started compressing the dimensions of the TARDIS,
his hair was the first to go, yeah. Although, I was reading, Jamie Matheson did a Ask Me Questions thing on Twitter, like a Q&A thing on Twitter today. And, one of the questions somebody asked him was that victory dance in the script? And if so, how did you phrase it? He was like, all I said was victory dance. The rest of it was Capaldi.
He just needed a thing. Some sort of weird 20s flapper dance thing that he had going on there. I don't know what that was.
Yeah, but I mean, this was a great story though, and it wasn't anything that got bogged down on details or anything. It was always on point, progressing. There was no, you know, extraneous details that they just threw in to flesh it out. It was pretty much all laser sight. One of the things I thought when it first came on was, oh dear God, please don't let this be another Fear Her. Like, that is the first thing I thought. And, you know, very quickly that got tossed aside because I'm like, oh, look, all the people are in the walls and they're gonna, oh yeah. Oh wait, they're dead as soon as they hit the walls. There's no coming out and running back to their families at the end of this. The stakes were set high, like instantly.
Yeah. Not only dead is dead, but also dissected. I mean, that sort of thing was when it was interesting that for a while, the Doctor was just sort of seeing it as, well, maybe they're just, you know, they're mm-hmm. not potentially dangerous. Maybe we just don't understand how they're communicating with them. Like, no, they're pulling the nervous system out of their victims. I think that's not exactly just, you know, waving hello by throwing gas balls around and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Planet of 64 stomachs.
So what did you think about this episode, Keir?
I enjoyed it. I don't know if I necessarily put it up there as one of my favorites this season so far. It's definitely, you know, up there. But I genuinely enjoyed it on a couple of watches through. I did like the fact that there was, as you mentioned, that constant toggle back and forth between icebreaker moments and serious moments, or I should say alarming or disconcerting moments mm-hmm. when dealing with them. Although that name, I'm sorry, we can't. Do we really have to seriously call them the Boneless? Really?
Yeah.
That was the only moment where I did the sort of the pushback from the coffee table and went, no. I name you the Boneless, especially with the Scottish accent. I'm thinking, you know, Toothless. Ah, Toothless. But,
What were we calling them before? Graffiti monsters?
Killer graffiti, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it was. There was.
Honestly, I think that's better.
That could have stuck. But no, I mean, I really think even though it was done sort of in that alternate shooting schedule sort of thing, the written dialogue, the banter between Doctor and Clara was really tight through this one. And that's one of the things that I genuinely enjoyed about it was the fact that put into the driver's seat, so to speak, when Clara takes these responsibilities on, she was relying on, whether she was in communication with the Doctor or not, she was relying on the tools and techniques that she had gleaned from him over the course of all their adventures together. So she was putting herself in that Doctor mode, and you could see where it was succeeding and where she was taking the companion's view, which is never always directly in step with the Doctor, and merging them to be the most effective as the situation called for. So, she'd go at it through Doctor technique. Sometimes it would work. Great. Okay. Move on to the next thing. Sometimes she would apply the Doctor technique. Nope. Clearly not working here. Switch back to human mode and deal with it with reason and compassion.
Yeah. So. The scene on the train when, Rigsy is ready to commit suicide. He's ready to sacrifice himself to give them a chance to escape. And she jumps on there. She's like, oh, well, I was just going to use this hairband, but hey, if you want to sacrifice yourself, that's your thing. I'll keep my hairband that I really like. And that seemed like a very, very Doctor thing to do at that moment.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just like, man, that could have easily come out of Tennant's mouth right there.
Yeah. Or actually any number of the Doctors. There's always a little bit of dry wit, but you can see that she's been gathering quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
So in terms of the, you mentioned Rigsy, I wanted to ask, I get the character, and I was, totally okay with the actor's ability to kind of bring that character across, but it didn't really jump at me. I'm wondering if it was just a matter of I didn't quite jive, with the actor portraying him, or if it was just a matter of he was a little too clean, too nicey-nice to be this Asbo kid. I don't know.
I think that was part of it, was he was just too well put together to really fit the backstory they gave him. And then the fact that it just seemed like, hey, this is, two, three lines of character explanation, and then boom, he's companion and you're just supposed to accept him. There was no real getting to know him or building up the relationship. It was just, and I understand, that got thrown into a situation that they didn't have time to do all of that, but that just seemed like one of those things that just, there wasn't enough time built up into this is why I'm taking him along kind of thing.
I gotta tell you though, speaking on the flip side of that coin though, as far as characters that you didn't really get to know, but you enjoyed them without liking them, Roscoe, the sort of the foreman, that guy is a right prick.
Oh yeah. I love the Doctor's line at the end when he's like, yep, some people died. Maybe not the right ones were saved.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was looking forward to, was him getting smushed into the wall, and I was denied it.
It reminded me of the Titanic episode where, the Doctor's able to save like two or three people and one of them's the complete jerk, and it's like, well, yeah, I wish he could have gone too, but I don't remember.
The casting was just exceptional. The guy was just horrid.
Yeah.
That face and the, and then the complete lack of imagination. So the fact the psychic paper doesn't work. At the same time, what?
Yes, that was great.
Did he kind of remind you of, what's the name of the janitor in Harry Potter?
Mr. Filch.
Yes, Filch.
Yeah, a little bit. Although anytime I see him now, I think William Hartnell, so it's, yeah.
True. Yeah. But yeah, it's as far as, some of the aspects of the episode were just genuinely, I mean, we were talking, I know Badger had been chiming in when one of our friends and viewers, Badger, had been watching through. And when he's sort of live going through it, he's like, okay, this is genuinely creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't even gotten to the point where they were sort of 3D rendered. That was the point for me where it went, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's unnerving.
When that like giant hand came out of the sky and scooped up a dude,
and then never happened again.
Yeah, if you had that one, Boy, and it was solid. It was very solid.
But see, that was the, that was one of those things I was like, at the moment, I was like, oh, things just got ramped up, but then you didn't see it again, and I didn't think about it till after the episode was over. I was like, why didn't it just use the hand again? But whatever.
Yeah, because
it used a lot of power and reasons and things. Yeah. Science.
And the squiggle monsters were creepier.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
So. Although you got to think that would be like a very simple cosplay to pull off. You basically just get one of those black morph suits and then print out pictures of people's faces and stuff and just smash it on your face.
Well, it cut into ribbons so that you have sort of a collage yourself.
But yeah.
And then shuffle like a zombie.
I was watching this and I was like, okay, this is kind of creepy and, you know, nothing really horrendous. And then you get the squiggle monsters and I was like, yeah, maybe I'm not going to let the kids watch this one because that's rightly, I mean, that was pretty unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of them shuffling, you know, I run into the same issue with The Walking Dead. These people or these creatures with poor motor skills seem to handle walking on train tracks awfully well. I mean, I'm expecting that in The Walking Dead. Every once in a while, I just see one of them, clunk, oops, oh, you should have lifted from the leg. No.
Yeah.
So here's, we've got, as far as some of the interaction, or some of the Dr. Oswald moments that she takes on, what was our take on the way that she was sort of reasoning and maneuvering her way through, dealing with the police constable, the MI5 bit, and her decision making process as she's trying to get from one, perilous situation to the next? How did that strike you?
I felt like the whole time she was looking at her wristband, the little what would the doctor do wristband she's got on.
WWDD. Yeah, and it really was. Like, you can tell that she has gained a lot from the doctor. Like, she understands the way that he works. She understands the process that he goes through. She might not be able to, like, reason everything out as thoroughly as he does, but she understands this is the step I take and, this is how things work. And it almost was at times like she was just going off of a checklist. Make witty remark, check. Insult their intelligence, check.
But then she gets to some of the ones that really punch, like give them false hope, check.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one of those moments where I was like, ooh, this just kind of took a slightly darker turn. Because at that moment, you realize that it's not just the actions that are taking hold, but the thought processes as well.
Even like the doctor's face when he says people who think they're doomed and she says Dottle wind up dead, like his face is like, ooh, she might be spending too much time with
his remark, so that's what I sound like. It was great.
I'm hoping that those are going to be some of the small things that sort of chip away at the walls that still exist between them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are definitely still barriers there.
Yeah.
The trust has definitely not been reestablished, to any great extent. There's the mutual respect and so forth, but even, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but there's that one very kind of chilling line that's delivered towards the end there, but
yeah, I mean, but the doctor knows that she's lying to him now. Like when Danny calls and she gets off the phone, he's like, yeah, excellent lying, Dr. Oswald. And she thinks that, he's talking about everything that she said to Danny. He's like, no, I mean to me. This was never an issue with Danny. And because they're in the midst of, like, running from the monsters, they don't really get into that. So I think that that's going to be something that comes up later.
It has to. I mean, if their relationship is going to continue, they have to get to a better point of mutual trust, or at least not complete trust, but at least the fact that whatever it is that they choose to keep from one another is trivialized. Because at this point, they've both run into situations where the keeping of certain things from one another has gotten one or the other of them nearly killed. So, at this point, but nobody's concerned about Danny. Poor Danny, just calling up. I'm getting some great park action over here.
Yeah. But did you see how quickly he was up off of that bench, though? He was like, are you okay? What's going on? Are you in trouble? And he was up off the bench, ready to go.
Right. And he's not stupid. He knows at that point it's got to be.
Of course, when they're sitting there swinging on the thing and Danny's like, yeah, it sounds very active. If you listen to the audio that's coming through the phone.
Right. It's like grunting and
heavy breathing.
Well, they were in a sex swing, so I think.
I was like, if I were him, I'd there would be a moment where I'd question, but then I'm like, no, even she's not stupid enough to answer the phone during.
Why did she answer the phone in the first place? Honestly. I mean, at that point, I mean, because what was it? Later on, she hits the can't take the call now. Sorry, I'm in a meeting thing on her phone. Really? I'm in a meeting. We're like, teachers.
Don't we work in the same place?
Like, I'm in a meeting with the ice cream man. You know, it's a meeting.
You know, no, I'm in the meeting. You're not here. That's why I was calling you. But no, I think at that point she was like, they were in the swing and the monsters were on the floor and she thought, okay, we're safe. They can't get to us right here. I've got a second to answer the phone. And then while she's on the phone, they start climbing the walls and she's like, oh crap. Yeah, resolve this issue.
I gotta wonder, we're mentioning the kind of the Dr. Oswald things. The sonic screwdriver is a complex piece of tech.
Mm-hmm.
With literally thousands upon thousands of settings.
Yeah.
And diagnostics that the doctor, through his, you know, millennia of working with this fantastic tool, the screwdriver, not his companion, has been able to understand all the little idiosyncrasies in the readouts. She's waving that sucker around at everything she can find, never looks at it.
Well, you know, in the first moment when they're in that first apartment with the skin sample on the wall, mm-hmm. you know, she starts doing it and she says something about, well, you know, maybe he shrunk down. And the doctor's like, I'd already set the screwdriver to scan for that. So what I'm thinking is she's just basically manipulating the screwdriver and all the readings are going into the TARDIS to him. So that's what I got out of the first one. But then later on, she starts doing more and more with it. And I'm like, no, at this point, you're magic wanding it.
Well, if every once in a while she would look at it, because obviously if she had the nanotech, you know, optic nerve connection, by the way, nice little thing, stick this in your ear and I got an optic nerve.
Yeah.
That's, science is fun. But she should just look at it every once in a while so she could be relaying the readings back to him, because she obviously has no idea what the hell she's looking at. I'm staring at a green bulb. It says green bulb, doctor. What does green bulb mean?
Yeah.
Readings indicate green.
When it says red, run.
Did you guys enjoy the part where they were talking back and forth to the monsters, though, with the numbers?
They're saying 8675309.
I love the whole thing about the pie with the doctor. He's like, circular pie, not edible pie. Although I suppose that would be edible, too. I love the part of him, like, down in the sub-level, working at his little workstation building the TARDIS.
Is his handwriting seriously that crappy? Written on that little piece of tape stuck it to this.
Well, I mean, look at all the chalkboards. I mean, we've got examples of his handwriting.
Listen.
But he was so proud of his little joke. He's like, no, it's to this. Get it?
Get it?
Womp, 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 womp.
No, see, that's the thing. I'm convinced he told her, you know, give me 5 minutes and I'll have something for you. I'm convinced he got it done within like two or three and then spent the remaining time coming up with a name. It's like, what am I going to call this thing? It's a thing.
Then he should have come up with something.
He actually figured out how to defeat the bad guys like 10 minutes in. Then he spent the rest of the episode trying to figure out what to call them. And all he came up with was the boneless.
Boneless!
Yeah. That's one of those moments where you leave the monster unnamed and let the fandom come up with it, because I can guarantee you we're going to come up with something better than Boneless. But in all fairness, this was Matheson's first Doctor Who script, so, you know, we'll give him a pass on this.
Yeah, quite a wide one. Yeah. I will say, as speaking in terms of how this series has been progressing so far, this is probably the only episode where Murray Gold's score has not really stood out much to me. I don't know if it was a matter of the way that it ended up in the mixdown, or just that it didn't particularly, you know, maybe the episode didn't have quite the same kind of a thematic feel to it that would have made the score. I mean, we were dealing with all these, you know, the Mummy in the Orient had that great 20s feel to it, and the murder mystery thing, and then we had, you know, Sherwood had obviously its very, very unique feel to it, and so on. This one didn't really, I mean, after going through it three times, I still couldn't tell you, other than I'm wondering, and maybe we can start kind of broaching this now, when Missy appears, she, I think, has a theme. There's a very specific passage that starts to play the moment she pops up on screen. And it struck me because I thought, ooh, have we got an official theme song for Scary Poppins now.
I'll have to go back and watch the other appearances and see if that's, if that is something that goes through, but that's, I didn't notice that. I mean, I was trying to pay attention to the music at times, but I've watched this 3 times now, and every time, like one time, the second time I was like, okay, pay attention to the music. I'm going to pay attention. And then I get wrapped up in the story and forget to pay attention to the music. And then in the third time I watched it, I'm sitting there and I'm like, specifically, I'm like, okay, how's the music coming along? What's the music like? And I'd get sucked into the story, and then I'd remind myself, no, music, pay attention to that. And I'd get sucked back into the story. So I don't know if it was just the fact that it was such a low key score in this episode, or if the script was just that good that it's not something that can be overwhelmed like that.
Yeah. I know at certain points there was a lot of Foley noise, obviously, you know, train tunnels and that sort of thing, and you had a lot of reverb. The sound wasn't very prominent there, but I got a feeling it has to be something with the levels in this one. You were also noticing there was something unusual in the audio mix. What were you catching? You had made a note about it.
Oh, just at the end when he goes to actually name the monsters, and when he goes to say boneless, like the music swells and the sound effect from the sonic screwdriver and everything, it took me 2 times watching the episode to catch what he was saying. And even then I had to go online and verify that that's what he said. Cause it was hard to understand.
Yeah, he did kind of get buried.
I turned the subtitles on so I could catch exactly what he called them. Cause I couldn't get it after two viewings.
Yeah.
I name you the bull. The sheriff is a bong.
Yeah. That was the only thing, that the only complaint I had with the sound in this one was just at that moment when everything hits that crescendo and, you know, for some reason it just got buried, but.
So as far as new things we've been handed this week, we've got, obviously the earpiece nanotech, very interesting. Mm-hmm. We've got siege mode.
Or as I like to call it, mini Pandorica.
Oh, it's so cute.
I mean, it really did. It looked like the Pandorica painted blue.
It was the Pandorica. I'll wait for somebody to frame
by. You're
going to
build
frame
a prop and use it once?
Yeah. This is the BBC. They're frugal.
No, but that prop was actually big. This one was small. It's like
No, this is like the model they made before they built the full-scale one.
Oh, okay. Model.
The original TARDIS set, right, with the little spool and the square knockouts or circle knockouts.
Exactly. So it's like, you know, in the scenes when they were doing the Pandorica and they had to build a little scale Stonehenge so they went did the overhead shots. No, they weren't going to build Stonehenge. They built one out of, you know, little pieces of foam and they stuck a little thing there. Yeah. It's only a model.
Nice pull.
But the whole idea of sealing itself in, you know, no way in, no way out, that kind of idea. So we're getting more defense mechanisms that the TARDIS has, along with, you know, things like the, the HED that we had from when it would suddenly just leave.
Yeah.
Shit got real. Bye. Just disappear. I'll come back when this is all blown over. Bye.
Yeah, I'm not sticking around to see how this works out. I'm sure you guys got this, right? You got this? Yeah, I'm going to just go get some coffee real quick.
I'll be at Starbucks. They'll be mispronouncing my name. The TARDIS?
You know, off topic, I saw a picture today where somebody had a Starbucks cup that said, I told them my name was Mark with a C. And on the cup, it was C-A-R-K.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Steven. I send that to the network owner, Steven, all the time. That's the only way I can remember how to spell his name.
There you go,
Steven.
Nice. Steven. So I'm talking about the train sequences at this point and what we're dealing with down in the tunnel. As they're dealing with the 3D wobbly bits and the whole idea of redimensionalizing or that sort of thing, what was your take on that? Because that was the big solution. That was the Clara putting on her big brain and saying, all right, I've got this kid who can do killer graffiti. I happen to find this spray paint can in this, you know, obscure
one spray paint can.
I was kind of hoping that he had a backpack full of them. I mean, he's a graffiti artist.
Yeah,
that would have made more sense.
Yeah, but he was actually there to cover over the graffiti, so, you know.
But then she found parallel tunnels, and she found the exact spot on the other side of the wall, so she could get it lined up just right.
Well, yeah, because that's what the script needed.
Hold on, I got my, in this drawer, I got the I believe button. Where the hell is it? I do like the train conductor though. I love this guy.
Yes.
She flashes an MI5 badge, and the next thing out of his mouth is, "So you want me to ram it?" I love this guy.
Well, it's just like probably every security guard always wanted to like thwart a robbery or something. Of course, he's always wanted to ram something with the train.
Well, and I mean, it was a defunct train that was out of service and whatnot. So it's like, oh well, I mean, they're just going to take this thing apart for scrap. So you know, why not help them along with it? Made sense to me.
I don't think it was like defunct. You know, out of service just means it's done, you know, on
the
line.
Yeah, they just weren't using it right now.
It's headed back to the terminal. It's just, now we're going to take it apart. We're just
Although, did you guys see the first train that almost hit the TARDIS? The big old numbers on the front, the A113. It's a 3D animation thing that you see it a lot in like Pixar movies and things like that. When, I can't remember where it is, but there's a school out in California where the main classroom for all of the 3D animation stuff is A113. And so you see it, it's the license plate on the van in Toy Story. It's in The Incredibles, it's the level and room number he's being held in. It's all over the place. And it's not just Pixar movies, but they scatter it all over the place. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, hey, that was obvious.
Obvious to people who know that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah.
Rendering nerd.
Well, it's just like in sci-fi when they use 1702 as room numbers on everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we get to our solution situation. They've now, you know, mistakenly passed their 3D mojo through the wall at the mini Pandorica, turning the power back on and restoring Capaldi's hair to its proper upright and locked position. And the TARDIS spins back into life and smashes down in a gust of light and wind.
Mm-hmm.
That scene alone is gorgeous.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's like one of those goosebumpy moments, you know, when she just comes whizzing out and smashes to Earth like you're expecting the TV to rattle because it comes forward with so much force.
Yeah, and this was the closest we've gotten to one of those Sermon on the Mountain moments with Capaldi. Like, I mean, Smith had him, you know, oh, hey, it's Wednesday, let's go ahead and throw one out, you know. Capaldi.
Well, it was almost exactly like the 11th hour when he's, this plane is protected, I am the doctor.
Yeah. Hmm. But I mean, that this is the first time we've seen him give that kind of speech, and it was just like, I was like, oh, yay, when he starts off, and I love the way that he starts it too, with the, you know, I want you to understand, I tried to talk to you. I want you to remember that. You know, and he's explaining to them, like, I gave you every chance to tell me that you were good, but you decided you wanted to be the monster. And he just keeps ramping it up and ramping it up. And I'm like, oh, things are going to get real.
Here comes.
The eyebrows are dropping.
The eyebrows have hit attack
They're going
mode.
Into attack mode. I think this is exactly the type of moment that our listener Soleil was saying he wanted in like the first episode.
Yeah. This definitely
just
was.
Come out kicking ass and taking names from moment one.
You know, but as much as that would have been cool, I think that it's more powerful here because we've had him all along basically proving every chance he gets that he is the doctor. And then for him finally to hit that point where he feels it necessary to like full on declare it. It just, I feel like it packed more punch now than it would have in the first episode.
True. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Because now, well, especially because in the first episode or two, he was still sort of establishing himself
mm-hmm.
for his own benefit. And now that he's, you know, fully in control of his faculties, he's got, you know, the full breadth and scope of all of his experiences and his memory back and so forth, that he can sell that with a lot more authority.
Yeah. Yeah. But it definitely worked in this episode, regardless of where it should have been or shouldn't have been. It was one of those moments that you're just like, you know, just screaming, yeah, heck yeah, that was awesome.
Mm. But he's still, I mean, as far as everything that he continues to carry as, you know, in his particular spin on what he's done with the doctor's persona, you know, the little jibes and the nicknames that he has for everyone. I'm so glad that they're staying with that.
Yeah.
You know, everything from PE down to, the ones he was thrown out in this episode about fluorescent
pudding brain.
And barely sentient local.
is just fantastic, because it's just that little tiny thread of disdain for humanity that just runs under everything.
And I love the part when, you know, they're in the whole locked room and whatnot, and the doctor says, "Oh, I love a good locked room mystery." And then he continues to berate this guy. And then when he turns around and says, "No, it's kind of like those locked room things in the books. It's this." And the doctor's like, "Wait a minute. I think this kid's onto something."
Wait, local knowledge is leaving. Stop it, Clara.
I like that he's got to tell Clara, though, not to scare him off.
So he's keenly aware of when you get too weird for the room. But he himself doesn't adhere to the same rule.
Well, he's different. It's
You're really throwing your companions in the deep end, aren't you?
I'm allowed to alienate things because I'm the actual alien here, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was a great line, though, when you said that you really like to throw the companions in the deep end. I'm like, wait a minute, hang on. Rose, Martha, Amy, Donna. Yeah, no, you have no room to talk here.
It's only cool when he does it.
And that's right. Just recent memory. Oh.
Yeah, seriously. Well, we're talking about moments that we're kind of digging out of this. These thing. Mm-hmm. The thing perspective shots. Coming out of the TARDIS door as we were dealing with the hand crawling and the and reaching out or that way, and you just see the fingers sticking out and gesturing. So that was whatever, you know, we're maybe 10 minutes, 12 minutes into the episode. I'm like, that's kind of like Thing from the Addams Family. And then at about minute 35 in the episode, you know, she tells him, can't you just move the TARDIS, you know, like the Addams Family? I'm like, thank you. Okay.
When he's like dragging the TARDIS with his hand, though, I literally laughed out
loud. I mean, that is the weirdest looking snail I've ever seen in my life.
It's a hermit crab.
That was great, though. And it was so, I mean, it worked, you know, him so like twisting his hand and straining to turn the TARDIS upright and whatnot. It just, for some reason, it worked. And it wasn't like, we're going to pause the plot and make you laugh. It just, it really did genuinely fit.
Yeah. But it's, that's, as far as a lot of the play that they were having through the door, like the handing the sledgehammer through the bag and all the little, the gags, the perspective gags that they were doing was all nicely done. I think the only thing that really was kind of, was irking me a little bit, and it was only just a lighting thing, was when his face was pressed up against the doorways, the shadows,
oh, yeah,
the shadows
were flat.
Off. Yeah. But there's only so much you can do, you know, clearly, but I mean, without blowing the budget on, you know, Capaldi's face.
Yeah. This was actually a really solid episode, and I really want to see Matheson come back. I mean, if you've ever seen Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel, this guy knows how to do time travel stories. Like, I mean, he's the one that wrote that movie, and he understands how time travel works. And I would love to see him come back and actually get an episode where he could incorporate some of that, really play with the time travel aspect of it. Because I think that would be absolutely fantastic.
Yes, and I'm really surprised, actually, now that we've seen the second script that they handed him. I figured that was one of the things that really drew Moffat's attention to give him the nod to do so in the first place. Because that was a very clever and rather intricate script as far as, you know, play with time travel. The repercussions of the potential paradoxes and those things. And so now that we've seen his two episodes, I thought, well, God, they didn't give him a chance to do anything with time travel whatsoever. So, but definitely assured that we're going to see more from him next season, guaranteed.
Yeah. I mean, this was the first script that he wrote, and this was pretty much his story or his idea. He came and was like, okay, this is the idea I have. And Moffat helped him, you know, fit it into the overall story and whatnot. But, this was pretty much his idea. And then after that, I think he was handed the idea for Mummy on the Orient Express. So, I'm not sure if because the script was so solid that then he got the nod for the second one. I'm not sure how all that played out, but I would love to see him come back and then just say, hey, you know what? Do your thing. We're going to cut you loose. You come up with something and just have fun with it, whatever. So I really do think that he is going to fall into the stable of returning writers. And I think that's great because, I mean, these past two episodes have been absolutely fantastic. I mean, nothing groundbreaking or, you know, well, I mean, this one might be one that you remember for years to come, but yeah, it's, I don't know. It's the episodes that you remember fondly without being the, you know, over the top, you know, story arc kind of things that really, I really enjoy and really prove how solid a writer can be.
Yeah. Now I know, cause we got a little background information, on his writing for this, that there were other scripts that he had originally, I guess years prior, had originally tried to pitch to Moffat that didn't end up going anywhere. I'd love to see, you know, what got discarded because they were probably far more bizarre or maybe more Matheson-like, I guess you could say.
A little bit more in depth, I'm thinking.
But I guess one of the previous editions for this script, until they realized where they were putting it into the production block, that it wasn't originally going to have the Doctor sealed or trapped in the TARDIS. And that when they realized that because the way that they were going to have to shoot it, they had to revise the script to so that they could shoot all of Capaldi's material within that finite amount of time. Mm-hmm. I gotta wonder what this was before, because I'm glad that it turned out the way that it did. Yeah.
I was going to say that I can't really imagine this working with the Doctor out of the TARDIS. Mm. Like it seemed to function so well because he was trapped in there. So I'm not sure.
Right. If the Doctor's out, then you don't have the Doctor Clara, which is what most of this episode was about. Mm-hmm. It seems like.
Yeah. Do you think that this moment, I'm not sure if I want to call it an evolutionary moment, but this next plateau for Clara came at the right time, or is it something that we could have had a little earlier?
I think it could.
I think it feels right that it came now.
I think it could have come a little bit earlier, but not much. I mean, she's been pretty well established so far. Like, it was, what, 3 or 4 episodes in that we were really like, okay, no, this is not the girl we had last series. This is, you know, this is the Clara we've been wanting the whole time. So mm-hmm. I think you could have bumped it up an episode or two, but I don't know. This is definitely the story that we needed that to happen in. Like, I don't think it would have worked in any of the previous stories.
Well, we're still trying to justify or at least come to terms with how quickly she flipped the switch at the end of last episode.
Yeah.
Which is still, I'm still not absolutely rock solid with that. And I know we've got some of our listeners that have chimed in that are still wondering exactly why that happened so abruptly.
You know, I think after seeing this and the way that, you know, she interacted with Danny and things like that, I think what it boils down to is the fact that she was mad at the Doctor and she wanted to hurt him like he had done to her. And the only way that she could think to do that was to, you know, tell him to go away, to leave and not. But then last episode with the last hurrah, she realized she didn't want to give up the traveling. She didn't want to give up her time in the TARDIS. She just didn't want to deal with him in that aspect or whatever. So I think it was an impulse decision. I think it was one of those things of I can't walk out of here and never do this again. I have to do something crap. Okay, it was Danny's idea. And that was just the first thing that came to her mind. And now she's just, you know, scrambling to try and keep ahead of her lie and trying to keep her head above the water while she's trying to sort it all out and make it all fit together.
Okay. All right. I think we still need, I'm not sure exactly what we're going to be dealing with next week as far as, you know, running around the forests of London and such. But, you know, I don't think we're going to have, we're going to have a considerable amount of Danny in the next episode, from what I understand, from everything I've seen from production shots and the, you know, and him with the kids and such. So something's got to be coming. It might not come to a head next week, but I got a feeling that something at least is going to get aired.
Yeah, it's going to get approached. Yeah.
And I think it'll be pretty.
Yeah, I think it'll, we'll start to get the fallout next week, and then everything really comes to a head in the series finale. I think that's the way that it's going to play out. But. All right. So let's actually, we've avoided it until now, but I do want to make sure we bring it up. The part at the end where, you know,
Hold on. Let me boot up my iPad first. Oh, wait. Hey.
Well, no, but before that.
We got another thing.
The line that the Doctor gives Clara when she's like, no, why can't you just admit that I did well? Why can't you say that I did good? And his line to her that was so cutting, you were an exceptional Doctor, Clara. Goodness had nothing to do with it.
Right. And it goes back to him asking, am I a good man? Yeah. Mm. Being a good doctor doesn't necessarily mean you are good.
Yeah.
Right.
Big G good.
Well, and the line, the little thing before that was, you know, when the Doctor mentioned all the people dying and things like that. And Clara's like, yeah, but we saved the world. So on balance, we're good. And he's like, what do you mean on balance? She's like, well, that's what you think, isn't it? And he says, you know, I think that way so that other people don't have to. And that was the moment where he realized just how far down the rabbit hole Clara has fallen. Like, if she's willing to be okay with someone dying basically like on her watch.
Because it's net positive.
Yeah. Then, you know, that's, you can tell she's becoming disconnected and she's becoming the doctor.
So, right, yeah. And I feel like a big thing he needs from his companions is for them to help rein him in when he's going out there too far. Yeah. And if his companion is acting exactly like he would, then they're not really working as the companion he needs anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't see the line. She might, you know, particularly, you know, the character may take it as a dig against her, but it really has absolutely nothing to do with Clara at this point, because it's the doctor coming to a greater realization of the way that he's being viewed.
Well, and you can kind of tell in her face at that moment that she's not really sure. She's like, did he just insult me, or what's going on here? Like, she couldn't tell what he meant by that. Mm. So, all right. But do we think that the fact that she's not filling her role as the companion now, that she's becoming too much like the doctor, plays into what came after? So, I mean, after that, we've got Scary Poppins staring at her iPad. And what was the
Generation
line?
Two.
Yeah, it's got to be the second one, because that's the one everyone still gets. You can get it for cheap. No need to go new ones.
You can't run the whole Nether Sphere with, you know, blowing the budget like that. You got to go cheap. Yeah, who needs iOS 8? It still functions.
Right, because then
you can get iOS 8 on the iPad too.
Yeah, but at least you can still use your old connectors, because you know, you still got the 30-pin things.
Right, and those cables are a lot cheaper than the new Lightning.
Oh yeah,
ones.
They are.
Yeah, especially when you're running the afterlife.
So, okay, what was her exact line? I forgot to write it down. But what was it?
I didn't write it down
it was
either.
Clara, my Clara, I have chosen well.
Yeah.
I have chosen. Like, I think even the closed captioning capitalized it. I have chosen well.
All right. So I think that this pretty firmly slams it that, I mean, Scary Poppins was the girl in the shop. I mean.
Okay. But if you call someone a girl in the shop, you're probably thinking someone in their 20s, right? I don't think you'd ever call Missy a girl. So is this a thing she's been working on for a long time?
Potentially, or she had a minion doing a it minion. Or something. Yeah. But I definitely think that Clara getting the number to the TARDIS was absolutely Missy's doing, whether directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they pretty much just, you know, put the exclamation point at the end of that one.
Mm-hmm.
I think so too.
But this does not in any way make her, in my estimation, other than the fact that she's just, you know, the makeup artist is having a field day with her, she's not villainous.
Yeah.
She hasn't done anything wrong yet.
No.
Nothing.
She's just creepy.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's all it is it's just that unnerving, like, you seem like you're, I mean, hell, we're calling her Scary Poppins for a reason. It's, you know, there's nothing that she's done. The only thing she's done is been incredibly nice to people who have just died, with the exception of the one cop who she was just a little bit too preoccupied to handle directly. I mean, that's all that we've gotten from this girl so far. And yet we're all like, oh, this is the big bad of the series. Like, there's nothing saying that.
Yeah. I mean, because before we had some of the background on the character, we thought the same thing from the early moments of Tasha Lem, you know, from the Papal Mainframe, because she looked villainous. You know, ooh, she's got like, smoky eyes and she's got a creepy grin. So she must be bad. And she was one of the doctor's best buds.
Yeah.
They've seen each other naked.
Countless times.
All the time. So I don't know. I think it'd be kind of interesting, if we come around to the Dark Waters, right? That is what we're calling that's the title part. We get around to the finale here, and she just happens to be kind of a misunderstood soul, you know, who happens to like bustles and chokers and such.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how this character plays out, because either way, whether she does turn out to be the villain or she turns out to be an ally, they've done such a great job of building up the mystery around this character that I can't wait to see how she plays out, like what this shapes up to be.
Mm. Yeah, because they've effectively handed us nothing.
Yeah.
Yep.
I like it.
Absolutely nothing. So, do we have anything else to say about the episodes, or are we ready for the stats?
I think that's it for this week.
Oh, yeah.
Little Red Riding Hood next week.
I think it's Doctor Goes to Jumanji.
So, the stats that we got this week, the overnight for Flatline is 4.6 million, which is so far the lowest of the series. The next lowest was Listen with 4.8. So I mean, I don't think that means anything, because I mean, hell,
not really. Much
Listen was one of the greatest episodes of the series too. So it's.
It also ran at a strange time in the UK. Mm-hmm. I guess they were saying that the Strictly Come Dancing thing that was on
before it ran a little bit long.
So yeah. Most people said, just to let the DVR catch it and all. So we'll see what the plus threes, plus sevens can end up doing.
But last week with Mummy on the Orient Express, we wound up with the 7.11 million for the final, which puts it in the top five, I believe. But the interesting thing was it got an AI of 85, which is the highest that we've gotten so far this series. So, I mean, above Time Heist.
Well, above the 84s we've been getting.
Well, we've gotten two episodes that were 84s. So, above that, I mean, but still, we're talking a swing of 3 points in the entirety of the series here. But still, I mean, the fact that this broke everything else is pretty substantial. Because, I mean, we had some solid episodes before this.
So, for those of you like me who don't really thrive on these stats, I think it's probably safe that we'll have a Series 9. I think the show is going to make it.
I don't know. I mean, it's still questionable at this point, but yeah. So that's all the stats we've got now. But I will be interested to see what the final viewing figures on this are, and the AI, because everything I've heard from everyone has been absolutely, you know, they love this episode, or at least were, you know, very pleasantly pleased with it.
Yeah.
So
most of the listener feedback we were getting that it was, you know, quite potentially their favorite one of the season, you two had expressed.
Preston said, you know, one of my favorites so far. Jeannie said, this is now my favorite episode of the season so far. And, Star Pie said, interesting episode all the way to the last. So, I mean, everybody that I've talked to has enjoyed this episode. Nobody has had anything negative to say about it, with the odd minor nitpick of, you know, oh, there's this or that little detail that, you know, I forgot 3 seconds after it was on the screen. So,
right.
But then, yeah, next week we've got In the Forest of the Night. So we've got another episode with kids in it, and my trepidation is high.
Nah, but they're a little younger. They're not the tweens. You know, I think we might be dealing with primary school kids. So
okay, with the exception of Stormageddon, name the last episode of Doctor Who with kids in it that was actually decent.
There are kids in Doctor Who?
I thought we thought that Courtney wasn't terrible.
No, not terrible, but the episode itself wasn't outstanding. I mean, it was, and that was largely due to the last 5 minutes of the episode. If you hadn't had that on there, that would have been a mediocre episode at best.
Mm. Well, true.
So, I mean, what was the last, you know, decent episode? Don't make me come
all
through.
All the stuff with Amelia Pond in it.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
Okay, but is that because Amelia wasn't bad, or because we knew that she was Amy?
No, I think she was a great young talent. Okay. She really kind of sold it.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that. But still, I mean, that's 3 years that we've had, you know, nothing but horrid memories of kids, with the exception of Stormageddon, who, you know, at this point, if
he didn't talk.
Exactly. Well,
Torchwood COE.
Dude.
All those
too
kids
soon.
Were great.
Too
just screaming.
Soon.
Well, again, I've got to blame the writers for that, because I really think that most writers don't know how to write kids.
Oh, yeah,
they don't know what to do with them.
I'm not saying it's the fault of the kids at all. I mean, I'm sure some of these kids are absolutely great and, you know, tremendous talents, but it's just, I have a hard time. Anytime I see a script or a trailer or something with kids in it, my reaction is instantly, oh crap. All right. I'll watch this one on, you know, the DVR or whatever. I can't get excited about episodes with kids in it. And I hope I'm wrong in this one, because it looks like it has the potential to actually be decent, but I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. But one thing I will be looking forward to is the bus that we see in the trailer. I want to know if they're going to fix this in the episode, because if you go back and you look at the trailer, there is a bus in there that has a big old sign on the side of it for Doctor Who Series 8. As the kids are going through the forest and whatnot, you see one of the red double-decker buses, and there's a big old sign on it that's the poster for it with Capaldi and Coleman on it.
Why would they fix it? I mean, it's probably in there for all of about 8 frames.
Possibly. I don't know, but that's what I'm saying. I want to see how this plays out, because that seems like either a big accident or they're going really meta.
It'll be like that episode of Supernatural.
Or this is just further proof that, you know, the Doctor actually does exist, and the show is a scheme from Torchwood to throw us off the trail. If everybody thinks he's fiction, then nobody's actually going to believe when he shows up.
Great cosplay. What?
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But let's see. So what other news do we have here?
Well, I don't know if you necessarily want to call it news, but we've got all of the confirmations. The BBC has come forward with all of the official synopses for the remainder or for the remaining episodes. Yeah. You know, as far as the way that it would appear on things like your TV programming guides and things of that sort. So,
yeah.
So, and each one, is accompanied with a small quote that typically goes along with it for press junkets and things of that sort. But because there are some other ancillary notes that come along with some of this information, you may or may not want to browse through that particular link that we'll have in the show notes here, because you will get some information aside from just, you know, the location relative time that the episode takes place. So be mindful.
Yeah. I mean, none of these are explicitly spoilery, but yeah, if you don't even want to know the premise before you go in, then you're going to want to stay clear.
Right.
And then we actually had an interview with Samuel Anderson, the guy that plays Danny Pink, who's been talking about what it was like being on the show and things like that. And one of the things he said was coming out of the other end of episodes 10, 11, and 12 and realizing, wow, I've survived. I've made it. I've really pushed it. Kind of makes you want to go one more year. Come on. So, we understand he probably doesn't die. So he's one of those people we can say, okay, you're going to be safe, I think. But this also tells us that he's not confirmed for series 9 yet.
Yeah. There's sort of a tongue in cheek kind of solicitation where he's asking for public support to get the return of Danny.
Yeah.
And if Danny can't come back,
he's okay with Orson either.
I'll put the fro back on. It's okay. But that says to me that, you know, it's that they've sort of written it so that if he doesn't get optioned again, he could potentially just be left off the table. So
do we think that this is part of the whole is Jenna Coleman going to be leaving or not thing?
That's the way I'm reading it.
Yeah, because I mean, like I said last week, I don't think that they're going to tell us. I don't think that this is something that we're going to find out before Christmas, because there's no need for them to tell anyone. There's nothing that's going to be happening before then. So
right, because when do they start production of the next series?
I believe it starts in like February or March is when they start.
Yeah, so there wouldn't even be, oh, she's not on set or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so I mean, at most we're going to have like, you know, scripts or possibly even just rough drafts of scripts, but the writers are usually pretty good about keeping their stuff to themselves.
Right.
Yeah, it's everyone else that leaks.
Exactly.
Well, the other way you can kind of look at this is if they were somehow sort of spin the plot on Dark Waters so that their relationship ends.
Mm-hmm.
So Clara stays on, but is not, you know, Danny's not in her life.
Yeah.
Then that's a safe way to be able to say, oh, well, you know, we could bring the character back if we wanted to because they're still, you know, work associates.
Yeah.
But we don't have to necessarily bring him in because he's not, you know, the one waiting at home for her.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I'm expecting for the end of this, because you know that Danny's not okay with everything that's going on. It's something that's been a sore spot in their relationship. And if he finds out that Claire was using him as her excuse for staying on or whatever the case was, he's not going to be happy about it. And I can see that causing the kind of fight that would end a relationship. It's going to hit that moment of him saying, you know, you have to choose him or me. And let's face it, when the other guy is the doctor, you don't want to throw that ultimatum out.
I could see him not even being like, choose him or me. Mm-hmm. It's, you've lied to me about this for a second time. We're through.
Yeah. And it's possible. Deuces. I definitely think that that is a strong possibility of the way that this could end. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But and then we've also got some news from Boris Hussein, the director of Doctor Who when it was first starting, has been awarded the Asian Media Award.
The Asian Media Award. Okay.
I'm not
really familiar with it, but
yeah, I don't know how prominent this is. I don't know if it's anything like that, but he said, I was one of the first Asians to be directing in television drama in the early 60s. I was nervous and aware of the importance of having been chosen from many other applicants for the job. So I think this is just the recognition for the work that he did at a time period when it was very, very difficult for them to get into the industry. So
I got to wonder, with a lot of this sort of renewed interest and media worthiness and recognition of these sort of involvements of Boris Hussein and Verity Lambert and things, that some of this wasn't brought about as a result of the biopic.
Oh, very possible.
That was done Adventure in Space and Time.
I mean, their popularity has soared since that movie because, let's face it, most of the people, most of the casual fans and some, you know, new Whovians have no idea who these people are until they saw an Adventure in Space and Time. And then it was like, wow, these people actually played a really prominent role in getting this show made. I'm going to go and look into it more. I mean, my wife has, you know, when we were watching it, she's like, I didn't realize most of this stuff happened. This is really interesting stuff, but it's, you know, she's not as into the show as I am. So yeah, she never really wanted to dig into it and find all this stuff out. Mm. I don't know. I think it's a really cool, but one of the things that just amazed me when I was going through this, and I've never done the math before. I'm sure I've heard it, but it never really hit me at the moment. But Boris Hussein was 24 when he directed the first episode of Doctor Who. Yeah, I'm like, wow. I'm like, wow, I have wasted my life.
I'm looking back. Holy crap. When I was 24, okay, never mind. Yeah. Moving on. What's the next piece of news we?
Haley, you've still got 2 years to make something yourself, right?
No, I'm 2 years past being able to make something of myself.
Oh, I've wasted my life.
I blew it. I used to be a child prodigy. Now I'm just old.
Aren't we all?
I'm brimming with mediocrity.
Then the last bit of news we've got is there is now a licensed version of the Seventh Doctor's umbrella. You can get this from the BBC shop in the UK or here in the States. You can get it from abbeyshot.com. You can go into the show notes at gallifreypublicradio.com/108 or gallifreypublicradio.com/108. And the link will be there for you to click on if you don't feel like typing out Abbey Shot, but because that's so much easier to spell than, or harder to spell than Gallifrey Public Radio, but whatever. But I've got to say, this thing looks incredible. And I don't ever see myself cosplaying the Seventh Doctor.
Oh, come on. You know, the absolute, the chiseled jaw and furrowed brow of Sylvester McCoy, the speech impediment and shambling walk. That is.
Plus, that's a pretty sharp sweater vest.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can also get that one as well. They've got that on there as well. So you can get
question mark sweater vest. Yes.
Yes. Or jumper, as it's called in the UK.
Is it when it's just a vest? Is it still a jumper?
Dude, I don't know. They call underwear pants.
Is it called a jumper vest?
Yeah. Dear British listeners, all three of you, write into us and let us know. If your jumper has no sleeves, is it still a jumper?
See, I just assumed that the difference was like, you know, when they wrote down sweater vest, they put in like four more vowels or something. That's what they
four
do, right?
Four sweater vests.
Oh, but I want this umbrella just for everyday use though. This is awesome.
You got to have that umbrella stand by the door to sort of complete that. Do you ever take that? No, I don't want to get that thing wet. It's a collector's item. It stays in the stand by the door.
Yeah.
Or you just carry it around in case you're ever falling and need to hang on to something.
Exactly. This is my life-saving umbrella. It saves my life. I don't know, but there was another thing with this, Kier, that you brought up. There was somebody was making these.
Yeah, no, you can search out there. You do a YouTube search for it and you'll find that there's a how-to on making one by heating plastic tubing. You know, I think it might have been like those shower curtain rods, you know, the ones that you crank out. But you sit there and you blast it with a heat gun and you bend it around a bedpost or whatever so you get the right curve on it and you can make your own. And there was a guy I was talking to as I'm standing in line for the when I was at the in the line for the Colin Baker panel at DragonCon. And the guy had one. I'm chatting with him for a couple of minutes. I said, that's really nice. That's a nice piece. Where did you end up buying that online? He's like, no, I made it. And he was giving me the whole rundown on it and going into the minutia of detail. And I'm looking around at the people standing in line with us. And they're just kind of, you know, they're doing the dog head, just wondering why he's getting so excited about explaining the fabrication of this thing. But I was like hanging on, like I'm doing this. I'm going home and I'm taking a heat gun to any piece of plastic tubing I can find in the house and making one of these things. But, nice. but now that, of course, when you get to the point where you can license it and it's officially sanctioned and so forth, I don't know. Does that necessarily make it any better?
No, it's just a matter of, do you want to pay, you know, $3 for materials or $35 for a finished product? So
I'm not very good with tools.
Yeah, it's not so much that I'm just lazy.
You set fire to your garage.
I'm accident prone. I'm accident prone. I shouldn't be using like fire and sharp objects at the same time.
It's a good thing you went into engineering. That was a good call.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's about all we've got for this week. You guys have anything to say wrapping up?
No, this season has just been firing on all pistons, and we got a couple episodes to go. I'm just so pleased.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like we're kind of just ramping towards the finale at this point, which is the part of the season I always like.
Yeah, that's when they really pull out all the stops. But all right, well, this has been episode 108 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I'm usually quite vague about that. I think I picked the title because it makes me sound important.
That was such a great day. This is Kira saying, do people still say chipper?
Well, apparently.
And this is Haley saying, could you not just let me enjoy the moment of not knowing something? I mean, it happens so rarely.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.